Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Me? Can you hear me on the phone?
I do. I've got you coming out of every orifice.
I'm really not. You're breaking up quite badly.
Hello and welcome to The Lock-In, where I finally get to talk to people I want to hear from in a place I want to be, the pub.
For some reason, this bloody thing has started playing back some rubbish.
Oh, right.
Where were we? I've forgotten.
I have too.
Today's podcast is one for optimists. We've just come back from a safari in darkest West Sussex. With my guest, our host, Issy Tree. We saw three white storks, among many other things. She is one of this country's most celebrated apostles for rewilding, which is turning on its head the way we look at the countryside and what it's for. She had the good fortune to have married a man who inherited Knepp Castle and 3,500 acres of farmland, from which they set out to produce food, as the government, the European Union, and the big chemical companies told them they had to do. It didn't work. Instead, they decided to let nature do its worst, or best, and now the estate is home to birds, flowers, and bugs, which were once thought extinct. You see, what was the light bulb moment when you realised you were doing everything wrong?
I think it was the bank balance. I think it wasn't anything more romantic than that. I think after 17 years of intensive arable and dairy farming on this very heavy clay, we were £1.5 million in debt and just couldn't go on anymore.
So despair, as it so often does, preceded optimism.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, if you're in a failing business, you're very much in the blinkers, aren't you? You're thinking about how to survive into the next month, the next year. You don't think imaginatively. And it's only once you draw a line underneath it and you say, OK, we're stopping farming, that suddenly the world opens up and you look at your situation with much greater clarity.
But you could stop farming and go into another line of work. It's quite something to say we've been doing everything wrong.
Well, I think probably one of the pointers was when we met this wonderful man called Ted Green, who is a tree specialist, and he was the sort of custodian of the old oaks at Windsor. And we consulted him about a 500-year-old oak in the park that was being split down the middle. And in the Second World War, the Canadian Army, who'd been stationed at Knepp, had tied it together with tank chains. But that was beginning to fail, and we wanted to see if we could save this great tree. And Ted came and looked at the tree and said, actually, this tree's in pretty good shape. There's a few things we could do, but it's absolutely fine. It'll survive for another 500 years. But he turned around and he said, those trees, those 300 or 400-year-old oaks in that land that at the time was ploughed, they're not so happy. And we sort of said, why? And he said, because you're destroying everything, all their life support systems. You're ploughing up their roots. You're ploughing right up to the tree trunks. You're destroying the mycorrhizal fungi with fungicides and pesticides and herbicides and nitrates. And everything you're doing is killing the soil and the organisms on which this tree lives. And we suddenly looked out on this horizon of these trees that we thought would survive into our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren's era, and realised that we were actually killing them.
You were lucky that you had married a man with a castle and lots of land, weren't you?
Yes, but probably not for the reasons that you're suggesting.
Well, you can conduct a controlled experiment.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a big enough tranche of land to do a rewilding project that could contain free-roaming herbivores. And that's been the key, because they are the drivers of the system. So if you have a smaller parcel of land, if you have anything, I suppose, under about 200 hectares, you're much more constrained. If you can't have animals living out there all year round, you don't have that sort of possibility to inject dynamism back into the landscape again. So you need to connect with other areas in order to do something as kind of exciting as this project has become.
What was the objective to start with?
The objective, I mean, I think we realised that working with the land rather than battling against it all the time was going to be the key to managing this very heavy clay soil estate. And our first step really was restoring the Repton Park around the castle, which had been ploughed up to the front door ever since the Second World War. And we got funding to restore 350 acres of that. And the potential we suddenly realised that was unleashed by that, just that first step, was incredible. I mean, I remember that first morning of walking out the summer after we had we'd reseeded it with native wildflowers and low-wheeled grasses. And the sound of insects was absolutely astonishing. It was something we hadn't even known that we were missing as farmers. And then, of course, after the insects came the birds. And suddenly we were seeing this landscape come back to life again. And we introduced fallow deer to graze the parkland. And just watching wild animals just, you know, meandering slowly across the landscape was incredibly liberating. And so we thought, well, this makes sense. It's the land is now doing what it's always wanted to do. Why don't we could do something, roll it out across the whole estate? But why don't we do something a bit more interesting? And we just met this amazing Dutch ecologist called Frans Vera, whose ideas about free-roaming herbivores were sort of really shaking up how we think about nature conservation.
Where did the money come from to do it?
So in the beginning, it was countryside stewardship scheme money.
So these are people have paid their taxes,
yeah,
in order that you can have the countryside, yeah, you like.
So it's sort of agri-environment money. So there's this, you know, sort of very strange two-pillar system at the moment in Europe, where you are paid one pillar of the money goes to incentivizing farmers to grow crops, principally arable, on any land, irrespective of whether it's appropriate for growing crops or not. And then the other is to try and mitigate the damage, the environmental damage that subsidy is doing, by paying you to reverse some of those. You know, so set aside was a typical example, which didn't work very well. But it's so agri-environment money, so it's higher level stewardship money. So it's part of that whole cap system.
But you can understand people being taxed to produce food. You can't understand people being taxed to give a bug a nice comfy place to live.
But it's more than just the bug. So it's the whole ecosystem. So that's what you're trying to do, is you're trying to restore ecosystems, trying to get land to function again. So I think what's been failing with the present subsidy system is that you are paying farmers and land managers to purely produce food without thinking of the damage they're doing to the soil. And we know that soil degradation and soil destruction is almost one of the most pressing.
Well, then you put fertilizer on it.
Yes, and then you know that, but that's a very short-term fix. It's a very short-term solution.
Yeah, but it's a fix.
Very short-term, though. And what's happening is that our soil is degrading and degrading and degrading. If you carry on using chemicals, you lose that structure in the soil, and your soil begins to become very friable. It's a medium in which you can grow things only if you fertilize. And meanwhile, It starts blowing off with the wind and it starts washing out to into the rivers. So you get this huge degradation every year. So in somewhere like the Fens, for example, we've only got about 15 or 20 years left in some of those areas of harvests before there's no topsoil in which to grow anything. So we have to restore our soil. So whether you agree with rewilding or not, whether you think rewilding and getting biodiversity back is a good thing to do or not, we have to change our agricultural systems and we've got to stop ploughing and we've got to stop using chemicals.
All the landscape in England has been managed for hundreds of years. Hundreds and hundreds of years. And you're now saying all this has been wrong.
Yeah. So the plough...
Generations of wisdom were wrong.
Yes, and we're repeating history. So you look back at any of the great civilizations. You look back at Rome, Egypt. You look at the Fertile Crescent, you know, where agriculture began. And look what's happened to it. All the soils have been destroyed. You look at the Maya civilizations. Civilizations have fallen because of this destruction of soil. And we're only just beginning to realize that the plough that was invented again and again and again and again was the worst invention we ever came up with. We have to start going into regenerative farming. And this is what's happening. It's not just here, but it's everywhere. In America, in Australia, the pioneers are the farmers who've gone bust, who've lost their soils, who've degraded their lands, and they're having to think differently. And so it's now, it's coming. It's coming our way. It is the future is regenerative farming.
How does it pay for itself?
Well, you're not using any inputs for a start, so it's much, much cheaper. So farmers, there's a wonderful farmer in North Dakota called Gabe Brown, who wrote a book called Dirt to Soil. And he went bust through, I think it was a couple of very dry summers. Then he had hailstones that destroyed his crops. He literally couldn't afford the fertilizer anymore to put on his land. So he had to think differently. He's now in the top 15% of producers in North Dakota, but using no fertilizer, no chemicals, no pesticides. His soils are now so restored that they are 6 degrees warmer in the winter than his neighbors. So he's elongated his growing season. So he's now growing crops, different crops for longer. And because he's not putting any inputs in, he's actually making far more money. He's making a profit, much higher profit than any of his neighbours. He's not even having to irrigate like his neighbours have to. And what's more is he's selling now because he's now so famous and his crops are grown on functioning soils. They're actually considered to be more nutritious. So people are driving to him to buy his food. And so he's selling organic food at the farm gate cheaper than his neighbours can produce their non-organic food.
So one bloke in North America can make
it. Has started a movement, yes. And this is happening all over America now. There's another wonderful guy called Dave Montgomery who's written a book about it called Growing a Revolution. And it is what's happening. It's happening here in Britain. We have Groundswell, which is another farmer's sort of movement, which is beginning to think differently. So it's to me, it feels like it's like alternative energy. 20 or 30 years ago, we couldn't have imagined that it would eclipse fossil fuels. But we know now that that's the future. Regenerative agriculture is what's going to happen. It's just we have to ensure that it's sooner rather than later. And there's huge vested interest from the food and farming community and in industry in keeping the status quo.
So is what we've seen here this morning with quite a number of people coming, wandering about, keen to see bugs and trees and bushes and things in a natural state. That's a temporary part of the evolution, is it? In the longer term, you think everywhere will be like this?
No. I think that this is very unproductive land, agriculturally speaking. So we'll always need land for agriculture. So on wonderful loamy soils, grade one, grade two, you would do regenerative agriculture. But somewhere like this is perfect for rewilding. So we're not only restoring biodiversity, but we're doing all the other, the sort of buzzword is ecosystem services or public goods. So we're sequestering carbon. So having gone from being a sort of net carbon emitter, we're now sucking down carbon into our restored soils, into the restored wetlands, into the vegetation you've seen springing up, all those new trees. And we're also mitigating against floods, so we're now holding back water. So towns and farms beneath us, and there's now another building development on a floodplain downstream from us, are being protected by us being able to hold on to water for longer in times of big rains. So there's all these big positives to be had from rewilding. So how I envisage it working is that you have natural, regenerative agriculture working alongside rewilding. So in areas that aren't suitable for agriculture for various reasons, poor soil or very steep or inaccessible, you would have rewilding projects. But you would also have rewilded areas running through your agricultural system. So the network, the corridors that would link nature, biodiversity hotspots together so that populations of species can function again, can actually have a hope of surviving climate change. And so it's the kind of webbing, rewilding I think is a webbing that moves through a landscape that connects it all together for systems to function again. And regenerative agriculture will make the landscape more porous, will make it more permeable for species, but you'll still need rewilding to have the full sort of spectrum of amazing creatures back.
When you look around here, you see an awful lot of ragwort, mm-hmm. which is anathema to a lot of farmers.
Mm.
What did your neighbours think when you started off like this?
We had poems written about our ragwort into the local newspapers. People were absolutely outraged. And it's a very odd thing, the sort of visceral response that people have to ragwort. It's based on very, very bad science, actually, that was done by the British Equine Veterinary Association, which estimated the number of animals, of horses particularly, that died from ingesting ragwort in a year. And they counted it in the thousands. And actually that has now been revised, and it's probably about 16 or 17, if that, confirmed cases every year. There is this hysteria about ragwort, and we, you know, as a child, I grew up thinking that, you know, you would go to heaven if you pulled up ragwort.
Yeah. But you encourage it.
But it is one of our, it's a native plant, it's one of our most successful species of plant species at sustaining insects. So hundreds of different species of insect depend on ragwort, and about 30 species depend on it alone. It's very late flowering. It's that amazing acid yellow. So it goes on until sometimes here it can go on till October. And at night, it's a great attractant to night flying moths. And we're beginning to understand that night flying moths are actually better pollinators than bees. So it's a really, really important plant. And if we have zero tolerance for it, it's really damaging our insect populations.
More generally, what did your neighbours think when you decided, sod this for a game of soldiers, we're not going to farm anymore?
I don't think there were... We had this very optimistic sort of gathering that we, when we realised what we could do, that we could actually get funding for reverting into a sort of nature conservation project, that we could restore our soils, we could see wildlife back, we could actually improve the balance sheet. We thought that all our neighbours would join forces and that we could eventually have a block, say, of 10,000 acres, which would be really significant. It would be kind of bordered by the river and by roads. And it would actually make a really exciting project. And so we held this this kind of evening with presentations to tell our neighbours about it and expected them to kind of get very excited. And there was this deathly silence in the room and people left shaking their heads and absolutely perplexed. They couldn't understand what we were doing. I think a lot of that has changed now. I think now that we have these headline successes, nightingales, turtle doves, purple emperor butterflies, I think now people are beginning to see that there was method in the madness. And actually, some of them are now attracted to the idea themselves and thinking of doing it themselves.
But these are just luxuries, aren't they? The purple emperor butterfly, nightingales, turtle doves and so on. They're just fripperies.
Yeah, I think you could look at it like that. I think, you know, it's lovely to be able to see and hear a nightingale, but is it
butter any parsnips?
Does it butter any parsnips? What I think it biodiversity species like that show, though, they are the icing on the cake. They are the expression of a functioning system. So what we know is that if we have climbing biodiversity, if we have, particularly if we have rare species coming back, something is working in the system. So it goes back to all the other things that we're providing that we desperately do need. We know, just for example, that the water that pours onto NEP from surrounding farmland, it's heavy with nitrates. We know the water coming in off the roads is polluted. But once it's sitting on NEP, on our lovely heavy clay soil, it's the purest quality water you can get. So our land is acting like a filter. It's actually cleaning the pollutants out of water. So if you're thinking about water companies are now actually paying farmers upstream of them to restore their soils and their vegetation because it saves them money from having to clean the nitrates and the pollutants out of the water and the soil particles. So that is a tax saving. It's a saving to the taxpayer. In their bills. Their bills will be lower if you have rewilded areas, particularly around river catchments and where water is collected for human consumption.
But these taxes that were introduced, the subsidies that were provided, the new chemicals that were developed because there was a perceived need for food, more food to feed more people.
Yeah.
And rewilding doesn't do that, does it?
Well, this again is the sort of the story that the food and farming industry will want to get across, that, you know, that food security is the issue, that we every inch of our land has to be under food production if we're going to feed the millions and billions of people on the planet. What nobody ever says, and the UN has done a report about this, is that we are now producing enough food for 10 billion people, and we're 7.5 billion people now. So we waste between 30 and 40% of that food. So that is the single most important thing to address if we're looking at food security, is how to stop food waste. But beneath that too is this threat that if we do not start doing something about how to restore our soils, we're not going to be able to produce food for ourselves anyway. So we have to move to regenerative farming. And a way that rewilding can work in conjunction with regenerative farming is, someone described it as pocket rewilding or pop-up NEPs. So what you could do is like an old-fashioned sort of the old rotational system of farming, where you would allow land to go fallow for a period so that the soil could regain its nutrients and its health. And then you go to return it to farming. So what you could do is you could rewild an area for, say, a generation, say, for 35 or 40 years. You'd have that amazing scrub we've seen coming up. You'd have your nightingales, your turtle doves. You'd be sequestering carbon. You'd be doing everything else. And then literally you send in those huge machines from the Forestry Commission that turn it all back into a kind of workable tilth and then start doing regenerative agriculture on it. And meanwhile, strategically, you've got other areas around you beginning to rewild. So your nightingales, your turtle doves, your purple emperors move into that neighbouring habitat. And so you could have a system where you're just alternatively rewilding and doing regenerative agriculture food production. And that way your soils are endlessly sustained and actually your topsoil continues to grow.
So this may be temporary.
It could be temporary here. I hope it's not. We're still on very heavy clay. I don't think it's ever going to be fantastic for even regenerative agriculture. I may be wrong. But certainly we felt very strongly that we only want to be committed to a certain amount of time. We don't want to commit our children or our grandchildren to rewilding if times change and they have to change the system of management it's under at the moment.
So when do you decide to stop?
Well, I don't think we would ever decide to stop rewilding. The wonderful thing about it is that it's endlessly changing and morphing. There's no goals, there's no targets, there's no end finish line. So what we'd like to see more of it, I think, is not when you would end rewilding, it's how would you connect to neighbouring land? How would you create a road bridge across the A24 so we could connect with people on that side of the road who are interested in rewilding? Maybe one day we could rewild the whole of the River Ader, the whole catchment.
Would you like us to go back to living in caves as well?
No, I think that's that a lot of people think that rewilding is about going back in time, trying to recover the past. And it's not that at all. You know, we obviously can't. We can't create a wonderful Eden before human impact with, you know, the planet has moved on. Ecosystems change naturally anyway, but humans have changed our planet so profoundly we can't ever recapture the past. But what we can do is we can create novel ecosystems. So what you're seeing out there is a novel ecosystem. It's something that we've put drivers in place to inject the dynamism again. So it's like pulling a glider back up into the sky so it can fly. You're using Tamworth pigs instead of wild boar. You're using Exmoor ponies instead of tarpan and longhorn cattle instead of aurochs. So you're using proxies of animals that were here driving habitat creation in the landscape before and allowing them free rein to kickstart new processes and just see what happens. And the key is just sitting back and allowing those large animals to be the managers of the system.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Those three white storks that we saw this morning, they would once have been common in England, would they? I've never seen one here before.
The last recorded white stork nesting in Britain was in 1416, so the year after Agincourt. So I'm not surprised you haven't seen them. So I think we don't know how common they were. They appear quite regularly on medieval banquet menus, so we know that people were eating them in medieval times. They're obviously on pub signs, they're in literature, they're on, you know, illuminated manuscripts. Our local village is called Storrington, which in Old English is Estorkton, town of the storks, abode of the storks, and it's got two white storks on its emblem. So we think storks were, and why wouldn't they? It's perfect climate for them. They're migratory birds from Africa. So, but they need a colony in order to breed. So, unlike most of the rewilding project, where we just see what species will arrive, we know that some species can't arrive under their own steam. So, storks being one of them, they need a colony. So, in order to get storks back into Britain, you have to establish a colony. So we followed a kind of experiments that they've been doing in the continent to bring white storks back, and it's been incredibly successful.
So what happens next?
With the white storks?
Yes.
Well,
any other species?
Yes. I mean, you know, we would love to... We're having beaver... Hopefully we're going to be releasing beavers here in the autumn.
Yeah, but they're imported beavers, aren't they?
Well, they're imported from Scotland, if that's
what
you mean.
Well, that's imported. If you're a Scotsman, they're imported.
Yes, but I mean, you know, we killed all our beavers. They haven't been a functioning species in Britain for way over 400 years. So we do need to bring back species like that. That's a key.
Why?
Beaver's particularly a keystone species. So, you know, as a fisherman, you should know that. So, you know.
Well, they wreck rivers.
They
make enormous dams.
Yes.
They stop the flow of water.
So the dams are a fantastic nurseries for fish fry. And if you look at any of those large rivers in Europe where you have beavers, the as soon as you have beavers on them, the fish populations start to increase. So what happens also, there's in salmon rivers, and if you think about salmon and beavers have been coexisting for millions of years. So there's no way that beavers could have functioned in river systems. Millions of them would have been in Britain alone and destroyed salmon. So what happens is you get a scouring. When you have the beaver dam, actually creates, holds back silt and creates that scouring beneath the dam that exposes the reds. So if you have silt, which is increasingly happening, pouring off farmland into rivers, actually beaver dams can help maintain and restore the reds. When you have the beaver dams are always very leaky, and so where you get the salmon runs is up the sides of them, where you get these streams that overflow in times of big rain, which is when the fish are going up. So it's a very well established sort of a system that, you know, it's been functioning for millions of years.
You're looking for other creatures to remedy the damage that we've caused.
Yes, you are. I think it's understanding that if you think about it from a nature conservation perspective, for the last century or so, we have believed that human beings have created the problem and human beings can be the solution. So our nature areas are very tightly controlled, very heavily managed. They usually have a target species in mind, whether it's a nightingale or a bittern or a suite of species or a habitat. And you're trying to lock down nature in stasis. You're trying to hold that condition, that habitat, to benefit that species. But what we found is that every effort that we've been making in conservation has still, our biodiversity has still been declining. So it's not working. I think what rewilding is about is it's appreciating the fact that nature can do all this on its own. It doesn't need us. And that there are key species that are drivers of systems, be they large herbivores or a beaver, be they natural water systems. And as soon as you get them functioning again, you can take a back seat, and suddenly that burden is lifted from the shoulders of human beings who believe that it's all up to them. So it's not only cheaper, it's actually more effective, and in fact it's the only way we're going to be able to get our ecosystems functioning again.
But you're looking at it from a very, very broad perspective here. Farmers are concerned with making a living. Which bits of this farm make a profit?
Well, the ecotourism business makes a profit. We also we are still producing food. I mean, we would still call ourselves farmers, although we're very extensive farming because we're ranching the cattle. We produce meat, so we produce 70 tons of venison, pork and beef a year.
So you kill things?
Yes. So the idea is you keep the numbers very, very low, the stocking density of the free-roaming animals very low. Because you want to have this battle with the scrub and the vegetation coming up. If you have too many animals, you will have an overgraze system, the kind of landscapes that we're very familiar with from our intensive farmed landscapes. If you have too few, then you have vegetation growing up into closed canopy woodland, which is very species poor. And we just drove past a couple of plantations that we planted back in the day when we didn't know the beauty of
woods.
Natural regen. And so that's why you have to keep the numbers down very low. Yeah. And we're very aware that we don't have apex predators. It's uncertain that apex predators ever would control population numbers. I think if you're looking at somewhere like the Serengeti, apex predators only account for about 10% of population.
Human beings are the apex predator, aren't they?
Yes, we are now. Yeah, yeah. So we are in effect the predator. Yeah. So we are culling the animals.
But you're not saying let's get rid of managing the environment. You're saying let's manage it differently.
What we're saying is that the more you can be hands off, and at this scale, you can. The only management we do pretty much is culling the number of animals. And if you allow
but who
everything
are you
else
to decide that.
That is a very arbitrary thing. So we want to you don't want to have starving animals on your you don't want to, you know, you're looking at the health and welfare of the animal, particularly if you're farming and selling the meat. So you don't want an animal struggling through winter. So we calculate our stocking densities on the number of animals that will come through the hardest possible winter with perhaps the longest, wettest spring. So you've got a very delayed spring flush of grass. And you calculate how many animals would come through that in very good condition. And that's the number we keep the animals to from stocking density point of view. But that also happens to be pretty much in balance with the way the vegetation responds. So it works in the sense that it keeps the vegetation from completely taking over and from it completely turning into closed canopy woodland, but it's still a very dynamic, kaleidoscopic mosaic of habitats you have out there with that number of animals.
That's still the apex predator calling the shots, isn't it?
It's us as an apex predator, yes. But I think there's another factor that we're missing, which is the landscape of fear. And that has a big influence on the sort of impact of herbivores on vegetation. So, you know, we've seen with the wolf introduction into Yellowstone National Park, a predator will keep the animals nervy. I mean, we saw some cows, but not very many, but they're very relaxed and they'll graze over big areas in a very sort of loose herd. But if there's a predator out there, they'll bunch together and they'll move on much faster. And that will have an effect on habitat because the vegetation will be released in certain areas. There'll be areas where the animals know that they could be preyed on very easily and they'll stay away from those areas. So there's a much more complex habitat we could have out there if we had a landscape of fear. So I think it is important in the long term to think of reintroductions of apex predators.
And well, I think wolves. You're in favour of bringing back wolves now, are you?
I am. I think not now.
There's no limit to your madness.
In Germany, they now have over 60 packs of wolves, and there's about 10 wolves in a pack. And you know that's a densely populated country.
Oh, I'd like to see you in conversation with a sheep farmer about this.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. But in Eastern Europe, particularly, and in places like Greece, where wolves are coming back, they are now breeding back those very fierce sheepdogs that can fight off wolves. So there are systems that that they are returning to. I'm not saying that we should have wolves now, but I'm thinking that one day, maybe our grandchildren or great-grandchildren will be able to make that call. Maybe there will be enough rewilded landscape for wolves, perhaps, you know, north of the Great Glen. But we could certainly introduce a lynx.
The lynx?
Yeah, because a lynx is a stealth predator. You would hardly even see it. It's very shy of human beings. It wouldn't eat your cat or your dog like a wolf would.
It's not a mouse.
But it's not going to be taking pets, which is what a wolf would very easily would prey on cats and dogs. But a lynx...
I wouldn't leave my hamster outside if there was a lynx about.
I don't know if a lynx would be particularly interested in your hamster. I think a wild cat might be. And that would be another good introduction, actually. A wild cat would love it in that scrub. But a lynx would be in dense woodland. It's a stealth predator, so it needs very dense woodland. And it preys on roe deer. And we know we have massive, probably the biggest population of roe deer in this country for 5,000 years. So, you know, it would its main species of prey is roe.
Well, then you couldn't shoot them and sell them, could you?
Rodeo?
Yeah.
I don't think the lynx would ever manage to cope with the entire roe population of Britain. And also, it would only be in those very densely, you know, forested areas.
I see. You never finished the answering the question, what bits of the farm make money?
Okay. So buildings like this that we're sitting in now were previously part of the farm infrastructure. So this used to cost us an arm and a leg just to keep the roofs on. This was a cow barn. That was the sort of dairy buildings out there. So these buildings now we're converting, you know, admittedly with capital outlay to begin with, but we convert them into office space, light industrial units, storage. They're now bringing in a big income stream. We have the ecotourism business that last year turned over about £600,000. We make about a 20% margin on that, which is way bigger margin than you'd ever make on farming. I think in our farming days, it was about -1% or +1%. And the meat. So those are the three main income streams for us now. And we still get high-level stewardship, which is going to be changed after Brexit. We hope there'll still be money there. We hope that we'll get funding from ELMS, the Environmental Land Management Scheme. That's the subsidy that will take over from the European system. And that, for the first time, I think it's incredibly exciting because for the first time, farmers and land managers are going to be paid for providing not just food, but for soil restoration, carbon sequestration, flood mitigation, water purification, all these things that we desperately need and that are costing us hugely now, that is going to be part of your payment. But even in a worst case scenario, if we don't get any subsidy at all in the future, we now think that we are a viable business, which we certainly wouldn't be if we were farming.
So do you think this is better than the European agricultural system potentially?
I think it's incredibly exciting, yes. I think there is a huge opportunity here to get rid of the mad incentives that we've been fed from Europe, the European system, for producing food irrespective of whether it's the food we need, the food we want to buy, or the damage it's causing to the environment. So for the first time, I think we're beginning to look at a different kind of system where you will be paid for farming responsibly. And I think together with those incentives for farmers and land managers to restore their soils, to deepen their topsoil, to look at their water systems, to perhaps rewild areas of water catchment so that you can store water and mitigate against floods. All these ecosystem services, including carbon capture, and obviously restoring the soils is a massive carbon sink. It's perhaps the most important way that we can fight climate change is restoring soils. All these are incentives, I think, that will change the mindset of farmers and land managers. But at the same time, there is the stick being threatened for the first time, which I think is also equally important, and that is the polluter pays principle. So I think for the first time, farmers are going to be have to pay for pollution that they cause, so at source. So if you are polluting the watercourses, if you are drenching your soils in nitrates and losing topsoil, then the person responsible for causing that damage is going to be the one who has to pay. And that hasn't been the system for such a long time. It hasn't been levelled fairly at farmers.
So Brexit is a great opportunity.
I think it is a great opportunity. I mean, I daren't say that it's going to be plain sailing.
I bet you didn't think that at the time for the referendum,
no,
did you?
I really didn't. And I to be honest, I was a staunch Remainer. And now, having seen how far the thinking has moved towards this reform, this agricultural reform, I think it's very, very exciting indeed. And if I had to vote again tomorrow, I would really have to think twice about going back into the old European farming system.
There you are, Issy Tree, proud host to the first nesting storks seen in England since the Battle of Agincourt, if you've done that. then you have done something with your life. Next week, I'm talking to someone who isn't remotely famous, possibly because he spent most of his life underwater, but who has certainly had an interesting life. His name is Matt Parr, and you can look him up if you're that bothered, or you can just tune in and hear all about it. Until then, stay safe. Don't do anything stupid.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.